And now we turn to labor. Andy Stern is president of the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU. It's one of the country's most influential unions, representing more than 2 million workers, and about half of them work in the healthcare industry. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And first, how would you grade, say, the Senate bill? Unmitigated success, success with reservations, or failure?
I'd say it's a big step forward. And at the same time, I think there are still improvements we need to make, and that's what we're trying to focus on right now.
One of the likely ways to pay for this will be taxing the so-called Cadillac insurance plans, plans with coverage worth $8,000 for an individual or $21,000 for a family. That's not something that you support. You pushed hard for a public option. That's not there. You've told your membership that you'd continue to fight for those provisions. Does that fight stand any chance at all of victory?
I think that the issue of whether or not we're going to tax people who works benefits is still an issue and still can be solved. If you're a state worker or a local government worker in New Hampshire, you're paying $8,000 more for the exact same health care that your congressional delegation is getting. And now, besides having to pay $8,000 more, you're also being asked to be taxed. That just makes absolutely no sense. We're talking about hardworking, middle-class people who happen to be in places where the insurance companies have really eliminated all the competition. And so it's just not fair that people who work are going to pay more than their congressman and then be taxed as well.
But, and you said this in a letter recently to SEIU members, SEIU does not accept that this monumental effort, that this reform that is so necessary to the health and well-being of our economy, our families, our future, can be over without a fight. What does that mean? There are only 60 votes in the Senate for this. If you won anything in conference that jarred one senator loose from support of it, it's dead.
Well, I think if we look at some of the issues that are worth fighting for, and for us, that's really about whether or not people can afford the health care that the bill is going to provide. You know, there are things in the Senate bill that provide subsidies to people that work. We're just saying the subsidies should be increased to where the House bill's subsidies are, which are up to $70,000 or $80,000 for families of four. And not just $60,000. There are issues such as what do we do with part-time workers? Because there's somewhat of an incentive in the Senate bill, you know, for an employer to make their workers go from full to part-time in order to avoid health care obligations. I think that's something we can fix. I think it is fair to say, as disappointed as I am, that the Medicare buy-in and the public option, we're not going to dislodge that 60th vote. But there are many other areas that we can make this a happier new year for people in terms of their health care benefits.
And in terms of you and your union's approach to elections, what do you make of the kind of bill that the Democrats could produce, having won the White House and a landslide in Senate elections and a very, very strong majority in the House? If this is the measure of that bill, what does that say about the ability of the Democratic Party to legislate in labor's interest?
I would say there is a really pretty significant and fundamental issue for our country, and that is how the U.S. Senate operates. I mean, Americans gave the Democratic Party in the Senate a gift, which was 60 votes. They had an opportunity to have a debate, and so far they've squandered the gift. Rather than using it as an opportunity, they've used it against each other as a weapon. And right now we find, you know, I can take my single vote if I'm a senator and use it to bend the entire body's will to my needs, and I don't think that's the democracy Americans voted for.
Andy Stern, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's Andy Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union.
We travel even further into the past for our next story. If you grew up watching television in the 60s, this might sound familiar.
Danger, danger, Will Robinson.
Which way did they go, partner?
The robot from the television show Lost in Space still has a small but intense following, and some old fans are paying big money to try to relive part of their childhood. From South Dakota, Johanna Saylor reports.
As a young child, Mike Joyce dreamed of two things: being an astronaut and owning his own robot from the show Lost in Space. Now 48, the retired Air Force pilot is sad he hasn't been to space. But Joyce beams as he shows off the features of the Lost in Space robot replica he designed and built by hand.
I was very famous at one time. Now I am retired. And I just stand here most of the time and look really cool.
It started as a hobby, then it became a business selling these replica robots. His factory is in his home's basement. Surprisingly, Joyce is able to build these highly detailed 275-pound robots far from any support services deep in South Dakota's Black Hills Forest. Even though Joyce makes a living building these replicas and has a model of the show's rocket in his backyard, he doesn't consider himself an obsessed fan.
Some people would say if you had a model, a life-size model of the Jupiter 2 in your backyard, that you're an obsessed fan, I suppose.
Either way, Joyce isn't alone. He's already sold 53 robot replicas. Each can take 2 months to build and sell for $25,000. Richard Molnar of Vancouver bought one of them and is thrilled to own it.
My robot still appeals to me because the 21st century turned out to be crashingly boring, and I still do not have a flying car.
Robot creator Mike Joyce still dreams of flying to the moon. So much so, he's now investing in another project. This one is about real space science and aims to land a robotic rover on the moon. For NPR News, I'm Johanna Saylor in Rapid City, South Dakota.
In the community of Franklin, Virginia, the holiday season has been difficult. For the last 100 years, its economy has been dominated by a paper mill. As NPR's Adam Hochberg reports, the company that owns the mill has announced plans to close it down.
Christmas time has been busier than usual this year for Billy Duke, a 36-year-old worker at International Paper's Franklin Mill. Besides working his swing shift at the plant, buying gifts, and taking his son to see Santa Claus, Duke also has been making regular visits here to a workforce development center to start looking for a new job.
You're going to have to submit the application and the referral sheet that Bill's going to print out for you.
I can mail it because I'll probably have to fill it out this afternoon.
Duke is one of about 1,100 people who will be out of work when International Paper closes the mill as part of a nationwide downsizing. IP hasn't said exactly when next year the plant will shut down. But Duke has already been to this center to look for other opportunities, take aptitude tests, and learn about unemployment compensation. And he admits that's dampened his Christmas spirit.
I haven't decorated quite as heavily as I usually do or whatever, just not all the garland and mess hanging like usual, and kind of been in a little funk, I think.
In anticipation of losing his $25 an hour job mixing chemicals, Duke's family is giving up its annual January vacation. But he says he's still buying nice Christmas gifts for his 6 and 3-year-old sons.
My oldest boy is getting him a four-wheeler for Christmas. And my younger kid, he's getting a bunch of Disney stuff. He loves Mickey Mouse and so on. And basically, I've tried to maintain that they don't have any impact from it.
In other Franklin households, though, children will be making do with less. Kirk O'Kleshen, who works in the mill's power plant, says his 12-year-old has lowered his expectations.
He's smart about things. We were talking about last night Christmas, and I want to buy him a set of nice earphones for his iPod. And he said, Dad, I don't need that right now. So I was very proud of him for that answer.
Of course, with the nation's unemployment rate at 10%, families all over the country are looking at a lean holiday. But in Franklin, a town of just 9,000 people, the loss of more than 1,000 jobs is especially profound. Judy Begland runs Opportunity, Inc., the workforce development board that's trying to help Franklin replace what it's losing.
It's jobs, but it's also the fabric of a community. The Smoke in the Stacks is a local landmark, and when all that is silent, the town is different.
And Lord, we do continue to pray for all the people that are affected by the closing of IP.
At Franklin Baptist Church, just a few blocks from the mill, about 40 members of the congregation will be out of work, so many that the church has put off its search for a new senior pastor until it's sure how its budget will be affected. And Minister Sharon James says it's an uneasy holiday for many parishioners.
Some are very optimistic and are looking at what the next phase of their life is going to be like. Some people are just kind of shell-shocked still. And there's just a whole range of where people are right now.
Still, the church has proceeded with its usual holiday activities, the children's program, the Christmas cantata, and this night of caroling when church members went door-to-door to entertain shut-ins. Millworker Nancy Hopkins was among the carolers. She's also a choir member and participates in a lot of other church events. And she hasn't let up, even though both she and her husband are about to lose their jobs.
This is what Christmas is all about. And all of us in this church
are very strong Christians, and we know that God is going to get us through this.
Like many of her co-workers, Hopkins says she's buying fewer gifts this year, but she puts a positive perspective on that, saying she's long thought Christmas has gotten too material. She says for many people in Franklin, this anxious holiday season has reinforced the importance of family and friends and the church, relationships she's confident will endure economic turmoil. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Our commentator, Andre Cădrescu, has been monitoring the coverage of health care overhaul legislation, and he says it's making him sick.
The saddest part about sort of being in the news business is seeing the news on TV and realizing that as the greatest and second greatest generations struggle with ED and that ever mysterious fibromyalgia, the news is actually helpless before the disease of boredom. One network ramps up healthcare to give it the patina of CSI urgency. Another network leads off with soft human stories. Meanwhile, cable news sounds like talking head muzak. Pinned to the remote like a 20th century butterfly, I try to figure it out. When we had Bush to blame, TV news was practically giddy. That president made instant decisions, and instant, right or wrong, fits the news, which is instant and always breaking. The internet double kills TV. On the internet you can have it long or short, Twitter size or dissertation length, and you can choose your news with sugar or cyanide, and what's even more egregious, you can be your own editor. That takes too much time, though, so the process of choosing what to feature and what to ignore still falls to the mainstream media. And how do that and make us pay attention? The truth is that we won't pay attention. We'll be too busy acquiring symptoms for the medicines we are supposed to call the doctor about. I haven't called my doctor since the last news cycle. So healthcare is the issue after all, because I feel pretty sick after half an hour of I'm not sure what. Doctor, can you fix the networks?
Andre Cădrescu is the editor of Exquisite Corpse. That's a literary journal at corpse.org.
This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition for NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Diplomats around the world are trying to figure out exactly what they agreed to last week at the Copenhagen Climate Conference. The conference was near collapse when President Obama and four other heads of state cut a last-minute deal to curb greenhouse gases. But it's still unclear how they'll do that and exactly who will participate. One thing that is clear is that the U.S. and China are no longer observers in the international climate debate, but leaders. NPR's Christopher Joyce has this story on the new shape of climate diplomacy.
The goal in Copenhagen was for the world's nations to draft a new climate treaty to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which is administered by the United Nations. Instead, negotiations collapsed. When President Obama arrived on the last day, he set up a meeting with China, and the two countries, joined by India, Brazil, and South Africa, cut their own deal, the Copenhagen Accord. Afterwards, Mr. Obama explained why he couldn't wait for the other 188 countries at the conference to agree on a draft plan.
This is a classic example of a situation where if we just waited for that, then we would not make any progress. And in fact, I think there might be such frustration and cynicism that rather than taking one step forward, we ended up taking two steps back.
Many delegations did not view the five-nation accord as a step forward, but all but a few have now agreed at least to note the new accord. The accord is less than many wanted. It's voluntary, and it postpones setting hard numbers on reducing short-term emissions. It pays poorer countries to adapt to climate change, but not as much as many of them wanted. Nonetheless, many in the climate business say it's lemonade from what was a very sour lemon. Eileen Clausen, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, is in the lemonade camp. She says people had pushed the myth that the world was ready to agree on a new binding treaty, and it wasn't, she says, because the United Nations-based negotiating process totally failed.
I mean, you should have had the UN trying to figure out, knowing where all the countries were, what was actually a possible outcome. And that didn't happen.
Instead, delegations from countries like Sudan and Venezuela burned up conference time with procedural tactics and, Clausen says, unrealistic demands.
It wasn't clear that anything could get done because some group of countries or some country was trying to hold up everything, which is why I think the approach of just trying to do an accord with a small number of countries was probably the only way to have anything coming out of this at all.
Even Europe, which embraces the Kyoto scheme for emissions reductions, was not part of that small deciding group.
I personally believe that the Kyoto track under the UN is done for. Nothing's going down that path.
That's Ray Kopp, a climate economist with Resources for the Future. He says the new diplomatic path could become two paths, one for countries that are part of the Kyoto Protocol, and another led by the U.S. and increasingly China, the two biggest emitters of greenhouse gases. He says that doesn't necessarily mean getting worldwide emissions reductions will get any easier.
As a diplomatic friend of mine once said, you know, China looks an awful lot like us. They don't want to be pushed around. They want to do what they want to do. And it's hard to kind of put a lot of political pressure on them.
But President Obama did put enough pressure on China last Friday to at least bring the country into the new International Climate Accord and, in effect, join with the developed nations. For climate scholar Kenneth Green at the American Enterprise Institute, the failure to get a UN-centric Kyoto-style plan out of Copenhagen is a good thing.
Kyoto has been an albatross around the necks of those of people who are genuinely concerned about climate change. The first thing they have to do is let go of the failed model, because they're pushing for basically two things countries cannot, democracies especially, cannot do. It's economic suicide and the exporting of massive amounts of their people's wealth to their enemies or competitors.
Green and other climate experts note the irony that, in the end, a few major economic powers ended up forging an emissions reduction deal among themselves, the so-called major economies approach that former President George W. Bush once proposed as an alternative to the Kyoto Protocol. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.